You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 13th of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Robert Bounds, and Emma Nelson.
Coming up on today's programme, as London Book Fair approaches, we'll be getting the lowdown on the event with the publishing director, Simon Prosser, who'll also be talking us through what's been on his reading list.
And we'll be crossing to Detroit to hear about women dominating the world of hip-hop.
Yo, my friend got good in that it's time for my gen TV head. You keep running your mouth, whoa, you just dead. See, Jinga Zongo Kuyipira, Pamweva Kazo Shaika, Tavas Pitira.
DJ Lahedi will be on the line for today's music review.
And fresh off the red eye from New York, Matt Wolf will be here to guide us through the hits and misses of Broadway.
Plus, there'll be our usual selection of cultural advice for the coming days. So, plenty to look forward to in the next hour here on The Review, live on Monocle 24. All right, the light screen, it's Saturday morning. Is it morning? No, it's the afternoon. We're just into the afternoon. But for normal people
We're nigh on lunchtime.
Yeah, we're nigh on lunchtime. You promised yesterday before when we were sort of slightly thinking about this show, Emma, that we could
more
start
than
drinking
slightly
it.
Thinking.
Well, I say it's like we just started thinking about it 4 minutes ago. I think we started writing the script, such as it is. You promised I was going to be drinking at midday. I'm not familiar with the show, but, you know,
I'm not familiar with drinking.
What have we got on the table?
We're drinking water at midday. So we are drinking, but we're drinking water. So there we go.
This is the bit where we talk about our cultural highlights of the week. That's what it says, isn't it?
It is. Now, you are the cultural editor of Monocle. Have you done any culture this week?
I have done some. I'm glad you did. It's been okay. I've been to two things that on the face of it seem to be cultural events, but essentially turned into alcoholic debacles.
Well, you did your drinking anyway then. So you've done that. So I don't know why you're expecting more, or you're continuing on a theme.
I think that was the carrot. That was the kind of the tin of Tennant's Super on the end of a bamboo cane on a piece of string that they lured me into the studio with this morning.
There's drink.
But yeah, there are a couple of things.
Tell us more.
Monday. Get your drinking out of the way on Monday evenings if you want to have a great, productive rest of the week. Because you don't have that itch. You don't have an itchy trigger finger for the rest of the week. You kind of just go for it. It was an arts. It was an art quiz, like a pub quiz, only much more badly behaved. I was led to believe it would be kind of these head honchos of the art world. The International Art descended on London for this art quiz at the Arts Club on Dover Street. And despite the fact that drinks were 15 quid, and many of them were consumed. I expect they're expensive. Hope no one at a senior level is listening to this show. and it just turned into this awful thing where there was an ice fight. There was almost brawling. And it was the problem with it was there was fingers on buzzers.
What were you brawling about?
Questions and whether who got the answer right first.
So only that is an arts quiz.
It was really badly organised.
Was it badly organised and was it... I only at an arts quiz would you have stand-up brawling to do with art.
Exactly.
I mean, most people it's like stealing your lover, taking your money. You were arguing about what?
Exactly, sort of you, Kandinsky. Soul of it, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, I obviously knew none of the answers, but I just like a fight, you know.
Oh, so this is your diversion tactic.
This is my diversion
tactic.
Doesn't
know, has his foot on his windpipe of his nearest rival.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a clever approach.
Exactly. And how are you? I think your week's been slightly more... sort of highbrow.
Well, possibly. I went to see Nabucco at Covent Garden and it was...
No fighting? No,
well, it was terrible. It was so badly done that you never knew who anybody was because everybody was dressed the same. Nabucco, who is supposedly in his 70s, was sung by a man in his 70s, Leo Nucci, a fabulous baritone.
Yeah.
But now, so old, actually, his voice is properly gone. And there was this great device that Nabucco has to go mad at the beginning, at the end of the first half.
Yeah.
You knew he was gone mad because you could see a thing going through his mind going, I'm mad, I must take my jacket off. And so he took his jacket off.
Did he kind of get one of his arms stuck in the sleeve or something?
It took a while. And you were with him, you're like, come on, get the jacket off. And then, of course, he has to regain his sanity near the end of the second half.
Right.
Guess what happened?
Put his jacket back on.
Jacket straight back on. It was great. Now, we were in really bad seats as well, so we only saw half of the set at any one stage. So our approach, perhaps a little similar to yours at the Arts Club, was to drink our way through
it.
So we had that terrible thing that you're at the opera, so it's an event. This is not something you do every day. But we thought, well, we had a little bit of wine before we left the house.
Yeah.
Then we had a little glass because we got there a bit early.
Yeah.
It's possible, bit of, you know, half-time drinking too. nice and warm, cosy, dark box. It was
the jackets
lovely.
Were off all
the
around.
The jackets were off all around. Well, I couldn't care less by the end of it. It was lovely. It was a lovely, warm, cosy, drunken, sleepy evening.
So that's how we do culture here on Monocle 24.
We drink our way through it,
exactly. It is imbibed. We are sponsored. We should be sponsored by some sort of, shouldn't we? That's what we need. We need a grog sponsor.
Health insurance,
possibly. The man with the prue will be here with his suitcase soon. You are tuned in to The Review. I'm Robert Bowden with Emma Nelson and Simon Prosper is here, who we're studiously ignoring until we play this sting. Now, the aim of this year's London Book Fair is to make words go further. What that means exactly isn't quite clear, but certainly with a keen awareness of the importance of digital, of the swelling market for translation, and the rise of self-publishing, this year's fair is embracing an entire world of words.
To hear to tell us more about the upcoming event, and having been very obediently silent for the last couple of minutes, is Simon Prosser, Publishing Director for Hamish Hamilton and Penguin. Welcome back to The Review, Simon, and thank you for being so patient with
us. It's a pleasure. It's very nice to be back.
I love Simon's voice. Whenever we come on the radio with Simon, I always love your voice.
Oh, thank you.
You sound like a book.
You can read me if you like.
It's wonderful. So the London Book Fair this week, what are you looking forward to with it?
For me, it's having been to a fair number of these, it's really a chance to make contact with far-flung publishers who I particularly share taste with, share books with, Spain, Italy, France, some from the States, and increasingly a few from Scandinavia too. So a chance to do that and a chance to talk about what we've been up to and to try and generate some heat around some of the books that we're publishing at Hamish Hamilton and to hear what other people are excited about and maybe particularly on the translation side, it's a good chance to hear about what's going on in other countries, which is sometimes hard to find out.
And I wondered, Simon, how much of it's a curatorial event and how much of it's a kind of a marketplace? Because I guess the two things, everyone's kind of revving up for both.
Yeah, exactly. It's primarily a marketplace, actually. So the people, if you go to the stands, what you'll see is a whole bunch of people beavering away trying to sell rights in books and also export salespeople meeting their colleagues from elsewhere and wholesalers, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you were talking about the number of people who you're doing business with, the international aspect to it. When you look at the run-up to the London Book Fair, the whole world's press is looking at how they're going to be selling their literature. How key to the global market is the book fair?
I think it is pretty key. I think London and Frankfurt, but increasingly London, which has really caught up with Frankfurt in the last few years, is very important. There's also each year, as you probably know, there's a market focus. So this year it's Turkey, a place I'm pretty interested in, don't know much about. I love Orhan Pamuk, but I really haven't read many Turkish writers. Elif Shafak's another one. And I think certainly Elif Shafak's here and probably a bunch of writers we don't know about. So it'd be good to find out a bit about that.
Elif Shafak will be leading a discussion on freedom of speech or freedom of the press. It is an absolutely key issue in Turkey at the moment. Yeah. I think the common thing that's being bantered about is there are more journalists in prison than there are in China. How does a book market work its way around that problem?
It's interesting. I was talking to a Turkish publisher 2 days ago, actually, who came to the office to talk to me, and I mentioned this, and she said, well, she was quite interesting. She said it's quite a nuanced thing, actually, and for some writers it can be a case that you want to... it's a way of actually raising your profile, which I never thought about. And that, in fact, a lot of business as usual does go on. It just goes on slightly under the radar. And I think the situation might be more complicated than I ever thought it was, actually. So I'm looking forward to knowing more. But, of course, personally, I'm a great supporter of freedom of speech. I'm a trustee of Liberty here, so it matters a great deal to me.
How are deals done, Simon, at the book fair? I mean, specifically the London one. When I mentioned that you were coming on the show and I was, we're going to talk about the London book fair, someone just said, it's just a piss up. And I wondered how whether that sort of changed, because we sort of have this idea, a bit like journalism, we have this kind of idea of a slightly fuzzy golden age of publishing as well.
Sure.
Is that the case, or is it pretty tight of people? Is your BlackBerry full of meetings?
Yeah, I think everyone's BlackBerry's full of meetings, but actually it is, I think everyone is trying to capture or recap some bit of the golden age in the evenings, and sometimes it really comes off. And you'll find yourself in a bar or a restaurant, pretty merry, like you guys have been all week. With maybe
we've just
been doing our research.
We're a little more austere in publishing, but yeah, when
I
people
don't
do get
that.
No, it's not true. I know. One interesting thing about publishing actually is that in London publishing is a lot of us do get along well with each other. So and foreign publishers are often surprised by that, because in other countries often there's a lot more rivalry. And I think we are very competitive, but also a lot of us do know each other and get on pretty well.
So what scale of deals are expected to be done this week?
Well, you're talking about something like Hillary Clinton's memoir will be sold this week, definitely. The sales are already starting. Yeah, for a certain kind of publisher, that's a pretty, a pretty must-have book. So I guess there'll be some competition from that in various places.
That's the call that we've basically made Simon miss. If Hamish Hamilton or Penguin don't publish this book, it's essentially our fault.
Exactly. Yeah. That was Hillary's people on the phone. I just turned it off.
But. Secretary of State today, Prosser. Prosser on one.
Exactly.
Anyway.
Simon.
Yeah, and on the fiction side, we already know. So we employ a scout in New York, and the scout provides a hot list of what's going on over there. So what we know is already, there are a couple of really good agents who've got big books that they've, got big deals for in the States this week, and that's the way the process tends to work. Big New York agent sells big book in the States at auction, brings it over here, and all the rest of the world fights over it.
At the opposite end of the scale, there is a section devoted to self-publication.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's very interesting.
Your face has said something else.
I think if someone really wants to publish their own book and can't get it published any other way, then absolutely fine. But I think it is to underestimate the huge amount of effort, logistics, metadata production, negotiation that is required to publish a book, actually, and to market and publish.
It does remind me of that Monty Python sketch, notes to the milkman. It's a famous poet. It's that thing when anything that's published by a certain author is overrated, and they find some notes from the Milton from some Robert Burns or something, and here he was, and what did he mean when he said two gold tops and one silver, and they're trying to delve into it. And I think there's a bit of self-publishing in that.
Yeah, possibly.
It is, but it's obviously something that the London Book Fair is having to recognise.
It seems so. And indeed, there is a big self-publishing site that Pearson Penguin, who own Hamish Hamilton, where I work, have actually got a big stake in. So I think there's a way perhaps that mainstream publishing can merge slightly with self-publishing in order perhaps to provide some of those services that self-publishers might find.
Let's talk about some books then.
First on the list, we had on our list, we can mess with the order. We were going to talk about Alice Rawthorne's book, Hello World.
Yeah.
Which I think we've got a copy of.
We have lots and lots of. I have it here.
There we
go.
Yes, you probably know. Oh, I'm glad you like the cover. Do you know the designer, Irma Boehm?
Yes, because I interviewed her last month, actually, for the Rijks, because she did all the stuff for the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam.
Oh, you did that piece. It was a really good piece,
Thank you.
And
she's lovely, isn't she?
She's totally great.
Yeah.
I love her. And when I was we were thinking about this book with Alice, of course, is the Herald Tribune's design columnist. And I found myself reading every Monday her column really quite avidly. Wrote her a sort of fan letter via a friend and met her and said, what the world wants is a book that's somewhat like the columns, that isn't full of design jargon, that isn't full of dry academic theory, and yet isn't basically just a puff about styling. It's somewhere in the spot in between all those.
It is terribly full, though, in terms of reading. It's not something that you can easily dip into.
It's a dense
requires
thing,
an awful amount of concentration. And she bounces across time geography within the space of a couple of pages. I mean, just this morning, we went from Wedgwood via Jonathan Ive to Mies van der Rohe and Le Corbusier. Yeah. And after about 2 minutes, I was like, where am I? What am I doing here? That there is an incredibly strong point being made, because she's exploring the impact of design in its cultural context, isn't she?
Yeah.
I just found it a bit dense, but well, maybe I am too dense to read it. I suspect that might be the problem.
I think maybe the thing to do is take a chapter at a time and just read it slowly. But what I like about her is that there's a lot of adventure in the book. It's the adventure of design, partly. So there is a problem, how does it get solved, and who are the people who solve it? So, for example, talking about Dieter Rams and Braun. Mm. And I think at heart she is something of a her heart is with modernism, really, and the belief in modernism, and that modernism can work, and that the purity of modernism is great. But that Irma Boehm was the first choice for the design.
Yeah.
Who do you get to design a book about design?
It was wonderful going and seeing her studio in Amsterdam, actually.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether you've been out there to see her. And it's such an amazing full room of sort of all sorts of random stuff. And of course, Irma makes these teeny weeny books as well. She made one for, I can't remember the name. She made one for an artist. And it was this tiny thing. It's kind of one of the smallest books ever, sort of thing. But the most amazing detail and the rest of it, made these huge things. And that's a great cover. But you're right. What happens? At what stage do you in the publishing process decide who to get on board to design. Obviously, when it's Alice Rawston, you've got there's a great interest in how the book is laid out. We were talking about this. There's a lot of words. The page, to try and give the listeners an idea, the words are really crammed to the edge of the page. I think that's what I can empathise with what Emma meant with that. But it's a different looking book, isn't it?
It is. And in fact, something not many people know, but one of the arguments about the book is, so take Ariel and Helvetica. Helvetica is a very amazing typeface, as we know. And indeed, it's had a film devoted to it. Ariel was an attempt to get around, as I understand it, the relatively high fees for using Helvetica.
Right.
And this book is set in alternate chapters in Ariel and Helvetica, and you would really be pushed to notice that.
Yeah, I didn't notice.
But it's just a little thing in there. But it's sort of so
it's Ariel a Microsoft font, is it?
Yeah. Ariel's a BBC's font.
Is it?
Mm.
Is that right?
Mm.
Okay.
So the book is very perfectly designed to my mind. And also I showed her some old Penguin books like for example, Ways of Seeing, John Berger.
Yeah, yeah.
And we all really love the look of that. She's very interested in Jan Tischold, legendary Penguin designer. Mm. So she's sort of trying to work within the constraints of, a mass market rather than an art publisher. And that's what she came up with.
I mean, I love the way it looks. I sometimes wish, though, that the words were allowed to breathe a little bit more freely, because there was so much design crammed onto the page that I was trying to find the design within the words as well.
Yeah.
And it is something that there are so many layers to the way that you approach this book. That it's something that it requires pure concentration when you go to it. Even though she, by all accounts, it is marketed for a general reader who knows a little bit about design but would like to know a little bit more in its context.
Yeah, that was the idea, definitely.
Well, it's a handsome, but it's the cover at least. We can all agree that is a
beautiful.
Handsome. It's Hello World by Alice Rawston, and that's out now. Now we've only got time, I think. They're saying for one more book. So which one should we talk about?
I think we've got Gone Girl.
Oh, okay. We can talk about Gone Girl.
That's Gillian one that neither Robin nor I have read.
But we don't need to, because Simon's here.
Because Simon's going to tell us all about it.
But I guess the reason I wanted to talk about this was it's a point that I often make, which is that there's a sort of fetishization of the new. We all talk about the new. What's out next month? And we're all interested in that. But actually, a book is only old if you know about it. If you don't know about it, it's not old. So, for
it's
me...
It's because it's not like it's going to be... Yeah. It's not like it's encapsulating the week's events, is
exactly.
it? Exactly.
So the thing about Gone Girl is a book that was not at all on my radar and then became very on my radar and then became so on my radar that literally every single person I seem to meet at work or out of work is reading this book. So it's a book that's sort of absolutely in the way that sometimes happens has become a phenomenon. So I thought, I ought to read this. I don't usually read thrillers. I sat down to read it. And
this is about the disappearance of a wife, isn't it? Of a partner.
Yeah, it is. And it's told in a really quite interesting way in that the first half alternates between the present-day narrative of the man who's discovered his wife missing and, of course, his interaction with the police, who obviously their first thought is, he has killed her, with a diary that begins 6 years before, I think it's 6 years before, which tells the story of the relationship from the wife's point of view, the disappeared wife's point of view, which is a very interesting thing to do.
It sounds a bit like the John Fowles novel, The Collector or something. It's told in that flashback and present tense thing. It sounds...
Lovely Bones as well did that approach as well. The victim, the dead victim's voice came back to you.
Yeah, and what happens with this is that the diary accelerates forward in time until they meet. And I thought, they're going to meet at the end, but they don't. They meet probably around halfway through, and then it goes off in lots of other directions.
Which is very satisfying, I can imagine.
Yeah.
There's been some debate about it, which is what I call sometimes almost literature.
Mm.
When at what point does a very popular novel suddenly jump up and be considered true literature and has a bit of a straighter backbone?
When it's on Simon's bedside table.
Exactly. Well, you see, it's absolutely not the kind of book I would normally read or publish, but I thought I ought to. And I was reading it partly with that in mind. And I think... at the level of plot and mechanics and momentum, this woman is something of a genius, actually. And
there's just as much genius in that as there is in a sort of a postmodern novel.
I think there probably is, and it made me think, oh my God, that's awesome. Like, how does she move this fast? I was like ripping through the pages. On the other hand, I think what there is, I believed in the characters in a more conventional way at the beginning, and I thought by halfway through it twists into something else, and you begin to realise that people are being very manipulated, the characters are being manipulated, it becomes something different and, to my mind, less literary, if you like.
I wish we could talk about this all day. We've got to stop there. We've got two more. We were going to talk about Mohsin Hamid's How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia.
I'm going to steal a bit of time,
Alain de Botton's Religion for Atheists.
I'm going to ask you, what do you think of the Mohsin Hamid book?
I think it's an amazing book. I think he's a really incredible writer from a very interesting place, and the book is... it manages to be both a great technical feat and very moving, and it tells you quite a lot about the world. It's very thought-provoking.
The story is called How to Get Rich, Filthy Rich in Asia, and it's a story of you, because it's written in the second person, and it charts the protagonist, you. You go from having a terrible disease under a cot in rural somewhere, then you're brought into the city and you become filthy rich on selling illegally processed water.
Exactly.
And then you have your inevitable decline.
Exactly.
And it's got some very, very strong points to it. But it has that Mohsin Hamid style to it, the direct confrontation with the reader.
Definitely, as with Reluctant Fundamentalists, which indeed is, I've seen the film of that Mira Nair's made of it. It's an incredibly interesting film, I thought, and in a way more real than, say, Argo or other films of that nature recently.
And very quickly, Alain de Botton, Religion for Atheists. The How to Get Filthy Rich in Asia is described as a self-help book.
Yes.
This, I found much more, Alain de Botton, Religion for Atheists, much more of a self-help book. I found it astonishing. Yeah. I shall now be living by Alain de Botton.
Ah, and then you can then follow his Twitter account and join the rest of us who, like Rob and I, who
indeed,
follow his aphorisms every day.
Yes, I know. It's kind of weird, isn't it? Because it depends. You get a great mix of following on Twitter of him and then some complete nutcase you follow. I like the juxtaposition of de Botton and pretty much anyone else in the world.
Yeah.
Other than yourself, Simon, of course.
On the subject of which, my favourite literary tweeter at the moment is definitely Irvin Welsh, tweeting sports reporting of the most over-the-top obscene variety.
And John Niven as well. His Glasgow mate. Very good as well.
I find it all a little bit like shouting drunkenly in a pub.
Exactly, it is. That's exactly what we've been doing all week in preparation for this show.
A bit like the arts quiz.
We're going to kiss you goodbye, Simon. Publishing director for Hamish Hamilton and Penguin, thank you very much for joining us here on The Review. Enjoy the London Book Fair.
Thank you very much.
Regular listeners may be interested to hear that all next week on The Globalist and Globalist Asia, we'll be running a series on the international publishing market to tie in with the fair.
Cheers, in the meantime, Simon. You're with The Review on Monocle 24. Up next, our regular look ahead for Cultural Weekend with Nelly Gotcheva.
If you like Subways, not Subway sandwiches, if you want to know what makes a metropolis thrive or take a dive, and if you prefer the concrete jungle to the muddy field, then you need The Urbanist. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we explore the urban landscape by tram, subway and taxi to meet the people out to make urban life even better. In this episode of The Urbanist, we're talking the talk as we look at the words we use to describe the urban environment. We'll talk to Sharon Zukin, the author of Naked City, to find out what an authentic city is, and actually, how it's very hard to have one.
It's the very diversity of cities that is authentic, and that's the quality that cities around the world risk losing.
We'll ask the editor of Domus about the words we use and abuse when we talk cities, and we discover what the Be Berlin campaign really means.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
All right, it's The Review at 12:27 on a Saturday afternoon, not morning. We got it wrong, didn't we, the first time round? You corrected me rightly. It is
it's always lunchtime.
We're live. We're from Studio One. It's The Review with me, Robert Bounds, and Emma Nelson. And we're going to cross to Associate Editor Nelly Gotcheva to hear some cultural treats she's dug out from around the world for us this weekend.
The Museum of Latin American Art of Buenos Aires hosts Historias at the Margins, the first ever exhibition of contemporary Brazilian artist Adriana Varejao in Argentina. Featuring a wide selection of ceramic works and colonial iconography from China to Brazil, the 40 works on display blur the boundaries between painting and sculpture. The show is at the Museum of Latin American Art until the 10th of June. Today's your last chance to enjoy the work of British husband and wife duo Boyd and Evans at the Flowers Gallery in East London. Displayed over two floors of the gallery, the show features large format British and American landscapes from the 1970s. For more details, go to flowersgallery.com. In Amsterdam, reopening this Saturday after 10 years, is the Rijksmuseum, redesigned by Spanish architects Cruz and Ortiz and rebranded by Dutch graphic designer Irma Boom, the neo-Gothic space and its 80 galleries are home to 800 years of art through 8,000 objects. For more information, visit rijksmuseum.nl. If you find yourself in New York this weekend, why not head to the Antiquarian Book Fair? This is the place where book collectors and dealers from all over the world come to browse and trade precious items. With offerings by over 200 expert dealers, you can dig out an obscure work for a few cents or invest hundreds of thousands in handwritten lyrics by Jim Morrison. The New York Antiquarian Book Fair is at the Park Avenue Armory until 1700 on Sunday. And on our playlist this weekend is the latest offering by Stockholm electronic duo The Knife. Entitled Shaking the Habitual, the album is available to buy now. This is A Tooth for an Eye. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
Thank you very much, Nelly Gotcheva. I haven't listened to her before. I like that.
She's a bit lovely. Scottish.
She's the only Bulgarian Scot in the building.
No, right? Full of smiles.
I like her. I like her voice. Now it is time for our weekly music review here on The Review. And today we're crossing to Detroit. Hip-hop's long been known as a testosterone-soaked art form, heavy on gun-waving, crotch-holding, bragging boys. But slowly and surely, female MCs have been making their presence felt in the genre, and it's been partly due to the work of this week's guest music reviewer.
We say good morning to Detroit, Michigan, and say hello to DJ Lahady. Welcome to the programme, DJ Lahady. Thank you very much for joining us.
Peace, Bob and Emma. It is morning in Detroit. Good afternoon, London.
Thanks a lot.
Good day, world.
It's a pretty early morning. What is it there? It's early for an MC to be up. Am I right?
It's 7:30, and I really just rock my own schedule. You know what I mean? So we do what we have to do. Joyfully. Thank you.
Were you playing last night?
I was DJing last night. I am a DJ. I don't MC at this time, but I was doing a wonderful poetry series last night, so, you know, very inspiring things going on in all of the arts in Detroit. I'm grateful.
Cool. Well, what we're going to do first, DJ, hey, we're going to play a song for our listeners to get them in the mood so that they know what we're talking about. First up, this is one of the tracks that you've chosen. We're going to play Cha Cha Cha. It's 2011. This is MC Melody. You could be your team, drop a whole routine, but on a mic, I murder, don't make a scene. As if I was a chef bringing old cuisine. All you wanna do is fight, don't be so mean. You gotta act right, don't be uptight. I know you're digging my songs like a true delight. Yes, I love to talk, giving you insights on how it's done on stage. I claim the limelight. Never stage fright, I'm the first in line. DJ, spin my verse, I put it on rewind. The crowd's hype, cause my style's sublime. So let me continue, cause it is my. That is Cha 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 from MC Melody. On the line is DJ Lahady in Detroit. Now, this sounds good. I tell you what, this sounds great coming out of our speakers here on a Saturday lunchtime in London. Tell us about that one.
That track is slam, and it is a tribute to MC Light. MC Melody is from Amsterdam, Netherlands. The duo who produced the track is Cook and Soul from Spain. So that track is slam, and people who know a little bit of history in hip-hop or have a feel for the sound probably know that track. And the way she came across and showed it justice and showed MC Light honor is, you know, it's ahead of the class. Melody is groundbreaking on all levels.
Mm-hmm. It's a great sound. I wanted to ask you about the East-West thing right now. You're in Detroit. What's coming out of Detroit at the moment? Because obviously we know Detroit, sadly, at the moment. It's a kind of underpopulated big city, right? Is a lot of the stuff coming out of Detroit in hip-hop, is it addressing those issues?
You know, most definitely. And, you know, in Detroit, it's music is so prevalent in everyone's life, you know what I mean? And there's a lot of people just just expressing music and expressing art, and definitely the state of the culture will be present in the music. There's a lot of people who emulate, you know, a precedent of style or a precedent of fad that's going on in music or that's going on in pop culture. In Detroit, I would say from my perspective, there is a lot of authentic representation of really what's going on there. And it is not the most receptive environment. It is full of soul. Detroit has been through things that has carved its identity as a leading innovator. You know, because when you have less to work or when you have challenges, you overcome. and that's what makes us, you know, set apart, and that's what makes people who live in challenging situations set apart from the rest.
And in the middle of this, you were talking about, Robert mentioned at the beginning of this that hip-hop has associations with being very macho, but you're pioneering, you're championing the rise of the female hip-hop artist. Where does the woman sit now in hip-hop?
Well, because I work with independent artists and because I pay less attention to pop culture, I can speak from what I know. And what I know about community, period, is that balance is the key. So while I am championing the female perspective, the female, you know, let me go with perspective, the balance is key. You know what I mean?
We're going to play another track, actually. We talked about women in hip-hop. We've talked about Detroit. We're actually going to Cuba now. in no sense of a link whatsoever. This is Nomi de Haron from Las Cruces Cubensi. Dicen que Cuba tiene mala maña. No me dejaron entrar en España. Dicen que Cuba tiene mala maña.
Dicen que toda nuestra gente se quiere quedar aquí y allí. ¿Acaso olvidaron cuando vinieron a colonizar? Sí. Desde antes de mi abuela la gente quiere emigrar. De España misma llegaron para mi familia fundar. Que la tierra entera es nuestra y el derecho de viajar. Huir, escapar, no es solo una actitud de quien teme. Es un desafío de quien más no puede sostener su realidad. Es la dignidad de quien decide cambiar, aunque a donde vaya no haya nada. Latinoamérica
tiene derecho a emigrar.
África
tiene derecho a emigrar.
Caribe
tiene derecho a emigrar.
Asia
tiene derecho a emigrar.
Tercer mundo
tiene derecho a emigrar. No me dejaron entrar en España. Dicen que Cuba tiene mala maña. No me dejaron.
Las Cruces Cubensi from Cuba, and that is Nomi de Haron. DJ Lahedi on the line from Detroit. That sounds good. That sounds, I can imagine that coming out of a low slung car. Where did you first hear that?
Oh, I first heard that. A mixtape that Cruces passed me when I met them in Detroit.
And that's good stuff.
And that music right there. Whew.
Yeah, right. How does that stuff get, how does that stuff filter out? I mean, you play it. As a DJ, you're playing that kind of stuff. Is that still the best place, maybe in Detroit, to hear this stuff? Is it on the radio? Is it online radio? Is it about hearing it live?
Well, specifically that track right there has gone over in a few venues that I play, because I do play a few venues that are specific to celebrating women in hip-hop. And Cruces specifically have visited Detroit a few times, so a few people in my community already know who these sisters are. So, and there is also, you know, let me see, there's a Spanish-speaking community in Detroit also. Mm-hmm. So those types of elements make it more, you know, people more receptive to that music. But, yeah, as far as people from other places, I think that my mixtape, for example, is a great place to check out music like this. World Hip Hop Market website, Nomadic Wax website, draws the attention of people who are looking for specifically global sound.
The important thing about that for me was I'd never heard Spanish hip-hop before. I've heard French hip-hop, which works brilliantly, and then you hear Spanish hip-hop, and then the language works amazingly well with the music. How important is it that you actually bring new languages, and how receptive are your audiences to new languages when it comes to playing hip-hop?
I would like to specifically... I spoke with a few people about the World Hip-Hop Women from the Sound Up mixtape. And that is a project that I'm promoting. That is a project that that I mixed, and it's co-sponsored by World Hip Hop Market and Nomadic Wax. And I would really like to speak with some more people about how they interpreted that. Specifically on my mixtape, one of my tactics was to allow people to hear the different languages that are represented on the mixtape as part of the music so that they could be more receptive to it, even though it may, you know, it may not be something that they understand literally. You feel me? So the way that I put it together, I tried to make sure that the language barrier wouldn't put anyone off. And I think that that came across really well in the mix. And that has a lot to do with the expertise and style of the MCs on the tape. You know what I mean? They all are very musical, so their words are our music as well.
DJ Lahedi, we're going to leave it there. We're going to play out with one track. This is Mazia One and Warrior Tongue. Thank you so much for joining us on the line from Detroit. Thanks for getting up early for us. That was DJ Lahedi.
Thank you. I'm grateful.
Yeah, it was really nice to have you on the show. Thank you. So nice to hear your voice. We're going to play out with Mazia One. This is Warrior Tongue.
Peace time, war this evening. Yin yang changing and creeping, no time for sleeping. My heart is heavy and deep and on the hustle like grind. Throw your sign when my chime go beep. All my people, they find they got that street sense. Now they always on time, don't need no pretense. My steez is fresher than pine scent to shine double back. Got that polish and the piece called Zom. Ooh, need me. Bass on the rhythm, hearts beating a spark at night. The summer's leaving. Breathing in the scent of the breeze. An architect with the keys. Skylock with the Nazi dreads. Yo, take a peek, heard a whisper on approach. Big things, just like wine. Secrets always riding home. Motorola always beeping off the chain. Maintain, they like to call me daddy like my name was Kane. I fight, call me caddy, raised against the grain. On the down low, daddy, I'm just playing the game, yo. With the little guns, come on, I wanna bust guns on the run when I come with that warrior song. Got my back to the sun when I rise in the one. Chosen for the day, proud, I'm that warrior song.
That was Warrior Tongue by Mazia One, as chosen by our music reviewer today on The Review, DJ Lahedi. She was on the line from Detroit. And if you want to check out some more of her recommendations, it sounds like her mixtape is on Nomadic Wax. Google that. Right now, you're tuned in to The Review.
Where it's time to cross to Berlin to hear what's coming up over the coming days. David Pleasant is here to guide us through it.
Berlin is one of the world's undisputed cultural capitals. Exhibitions, shows, concerts, festivals, and special events abound. Key to the city's culture is a strong sense of diversity and freedom, something being examined this year by Diversity Destroyed, a series of projects happening across the city. The exhibitions and events deal with life during the Nazi dictatorship. Jewish, gay, alternative, underground, and extraordinary, each element tells its own tale. The German Historical Museum is providing an overview at its Unter den Linden site. Why not continue the cultural adventure by watching a silent movie? There are some classics being played out and accompanied by musical maestros on the piano, in an orchestra, or in a choir. Must-sees include The Adventures of Prince Ahmed and Berlin, The Symphony of a Great City, a classic modernist urban celebration. The films are being played at the Admiralpalast.
Sunny day, sleeping off, clouds away.
And for something lighter, why not pop into the National Museum of Film and Television, where 40 years of Sesame Street is being celebrated with a retrospective of the cast, props and footage.
How to get to Sesame Street.
Finally, there's nowhere better to end your esoteric Berlin cultural crusade with some time in the city's, if not Europe's, if not the world's most famous nightclub, the almighty Berghain. This temple to electronic music is a former power station and doesn't close during the weekend. Doing his stint at the moment is acclaimed Swedish DJ and impresario Rod Hard. For Monocle, in Berlin, I'm David Pleasant.
I've no idea what the name of that is.
That's Rod Hard with Hope. Now, that is a word that's got so many accents on it that if people write in, I do apologise in advance. That's Rod Hard with Hope, finishing off our Berlin weekend look ahead from David Pleasant there. And you're tuned in to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be putting on our glad rags after this to take a trip to Broadway.
Monocle Magazine is an essential monthly briefing of affairs, business, culture, design and travel. For £90 sterling, we'll deliver the whole year round to your home, regardless of where that might be. That's 10 issues, plus our summer and winter newspapers, Mediterraneo and Alpino, and our exclusive Monocle tote bag, designed by our creative team. Plus, all annual subscriptions allow you access to our extensive online archive. So subscribe today for a year of essential briefings. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
Berlin has long been a magnet for artists. As the city continues to evolve, Monocle Films explores how galleries and artists are being influenced by Berlin's complex presence.
One of the reasons that I'm in Berlin, and which is intriguing for me, is that the history is here. It's not necessarily in these bricks and mortar. It's somehow in this atmosphere. One of the great things with Berlin is it takes time to do things. Berlin is slow enough for art to happen.
Art in Berlin, a film about ghosts of the past with a view to the future, on monocle.com.
Welcome back. It's Saturday, so you must be listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson, and Robert Bound. It's time now to get the latest from the theatre world, where our next guest is sitting laid out with programmes, yes. More programmes than I think I've ever seen.
Well, are you going to say shake a stick
few,
at?
A few.
No, a few. He's ready and he's armed with his theatre programmes.
Yes.
Matt Wolfe, IHT Theatre Critic, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
It's the Dream Team, we're here today, yes.
It's awesome. Right.
Us happy few, us merry band of brothers and sisters, it's a review.
We're not going into battle, Rob.
We could be, I don't know.
Theatre battle.
With a rolled up programme, how well would we do?
You know what's really...
Matt Damon used a phone directory in The Bourne Identity, very famously, to fend off a stabbing, so who knows?
They serve all sorts of multiple purposes, these playbills.
They're really good for propping up tables.
Yeah.
There's rocky, wonky tables in cafes after you've been to the theatre. They're perfect.
And you have a much admired and much eBayable, presumably, one there. It's Tom Hanks's Lucky Guy.
Yeah.
Broadway debut.
Yeah, the funny thing about, well, any Broadway show, but particularly something with a two-time Oscar-winning star like Tom Hanks making his Broadway debut, is that the theater tickets are extortionate, but the playbills are free. So you can go through the auditorium and scour around for playbills. But if you want to see the show, you have to pay upwards of $300 or more a ticket. And that's because, and it was ever thus, the market forces in Broadway continue to rule. These Hollywood stars, when they deign to do theater, don't want to do it for very long. Obviously, nobody's running a charity. The producers have to make their money back. And so in this case, they've got 12 weeks to recoup, which they will. I mean, the show is selling out, and I don't think there's a ticket to be had.
This is something that we've spoken about before on The Review. We had
Al Pacino. And Glenn Ross. That's right.
They all did it. They're all doing it at the moment. Is there any end in sight to this, or is this just the way that Broadway is going to go?
Well, I think it's the way the West End is going to go as well. I mean, you know, Helen Mirren, if she's a big star in this country and in America, and she's here doing the audience for 16 weeks, and they're selling premium seats to that for about $200 in American money. I think what's happening, of course, is, you know, these big stars want to do theater. They certainly enjoy it. Why shouldn't they do it? But they don't want to sign on for 6 months or 9 months or a year. Those days are over. And so there's a very difficult financial equation here, which is how in heaven's name do you make it work commercially and also satisfy the talent, as it were.
Now, Lucky Guy, Tom Hanks's debut on Broadway.
Yeah.
It's a story about newspaper land, isn't it? And a legendary newspaper man. Maybe give us a bit of background. So before we judge old Tom,
yeah.
Before you do.
Yeah, it's a really interesting show to see in New York.
Yeah.
It's sort of been subtitled a New York play, and it really is. And in fact, the cover of the playbill doesn't have a picture of Mr. Hanks. It has a picture of the New York skyline. And that tells you sort of how they're pitching it to their target audience. It's about a journalist who's no longer living. He died of cancer, age 41, named Mike McAlary, who was in his heyday, kind of king of the American tabloid press, the New York tabloid press. And in fact, Nora Ephron, who wrote the play, who herself died last year, age 71, it sort of shows him ricocheting amongst the various tabloid newspapers in New York of the day, from New York Newsday to the New York Post to the New York Daily News and back again, at a time when, and this has all changed, at a time when there was a kind of rough, gritty bravura to the New York tabloids. It wasn't something to be ashamed of. It was actually, you know, you were out there, the rough and tumble of journalism on the knife edge. The New York Times was, of course, the established newspaper of the elite, but that was all very poncy. This was kind of really getting your nails dirty. And he was there at the forefront of it, not by all accounts, and the play doesn't in any way particularly whitewash him, not necessarily the most pleasant to people, quite abrasive, quite bullshy, as you would expect from, you know, a hard-hitting tabloid reporter, but, you know, at his best, very, very good. And he won a Pulitzer Prize for a particular story that he covered not long before he died. So he was lucky in that respect, and then, of course, unlucky with his premature death.
How much is this a good play depicting a good, a particular moment in time?
Well, what's interesting about it is the reviews for it amongst the New York critics have generally been very good. And it's interesting because I think it's a play that journalists, and of course critics are journalists, you know, we are journalists, we're all part of this profession together, will really respond to. Because when you think about it, there aren't that many plays actually about journalism, famously The Front Page, but I mean, that's decades old. And I can count them probably on one hand. There are a lot of movies about journalism, like All the President's Men and Absence of Malice, but it tends not to be shown on stage very much. So I think the critics were sort of chuffed to see a play about a community that they know. I mean, you know, they all know how these newspapers work. Is it a good play, Emma? It originally apparently began life as a would-be screenplay, and then that never happened, and so Nora Ephron reconceived it for the stage. And I think you can sort of tell that, and there's some speculation, though this is just speculation, that one of the reasons Tom Hanks is doing it on Broadway is maybe to get it into some shape to then do a movie of it. The main producer on it is Colin Callender, who is the head honcho at HBO, the American cable channel. So there are all sorts of kind of celluloid connections. It's not deep. I wouldn't say it's profound, it's sketchy, it's episodic, but within the terrain that it travels, it's very entertaining. And I think that if you go with that in mind and you're not expecting, you know, the new Chekhov, you're going to have a very satisfying evening.
Robert mentioned at the beginning of the program the idea of the, what was it, the Monty Python milk notes for the milkman, that once someone has died, then everybody starts to examine everything in great detail and, you know, what did they mean? Mm. Do we have a slight case of this here?
Well, of course, his family are still around, and his widow, played in the play by Maura Tierney, who's known to audiences from ER and things like that, and The Good Wife, the real Alice McAlery, was there at the press night. He has children, apparently quite a lot of children, according to the play, although I never saw them photographed at press night, so maybe they just blended into the crowd, or maybe got lost track of how many there are or were.
They're not thanked in the playbill.
They're conspicuously not thanked in the playbill, but I hope they didn't have to pay $300 a ticket. I think the worry is it's just going to be hagiography, and we're just going to get a sort of endless promotion of what this guy did valiantly to sort of uphold the principles of the New York underclass between the mid-1980s and the 1990s when he died. And it isn't that. You know, he was one of these who would knock on doors and interview people when they were at their lowest and most debased, and you know, that thin wedge of journalism where you think, can't the journalist just go away and leave us alone? But on the other hand, he was a great champion of certain racial and sexual issues. And so the play shows you all of that.
Let's move on to Tom Hanks, because obviously we've been building up to this. Is he any good? I mean, I've seen the picture of him, and he has a proper Arthur Miller face.
He's really good. I mean, the funny thing, he's way too old for the part, but who cares? I mean, this isn't a documentary. Tom Hanks is, what, mid-50s, 55, 56, and this guy was 41 when he died, but that doesn't really matter. What Tom Hanks brings to it is real conviction, and in a way, and he's also just technically, and this is something I think worth pointing out, he does have a proper stage voice. He did begin in the theater. He began at the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival in Ohio a long time ago. And in fact, interestingly, it's got a cast of 14, which by Broadway standards is positively epic. And one of the other actors in the cast is a lovely New York theater actor called Peter Scolari, who was Tom Hanks's co-star in a television series that they were both in the early 80s called Bosom Buddies, which was one of the very first things Tom Hanks did. So here he and Scolari are 30-odd years later. Scolari is still a jobbing actor on Broadway. Tom Hanks, a multi-million-dollar movie star. But he has a natural command of the stage, and that's worth saying, because sometimes you go to see these film people on Broadway. I remember Jessica Lange doing a play on Broadway and somebody shouting 20 minutes into the first act, "Speak up!" Because, you know, they were used to talking to the camera, which was right, you know, where this microphone is, and they didn't realize there are 1,200 people here. There's none of that with him. And because he still does have it, it's slightly faded a bit, but there's still this feeling with Tom Hanks of kind of Mr. Nice Guy America. That we bring that to the party. That's already there for free. And that works very well in our appraisal of a guy who probably was perhaps a little more abrasive than the Tom Hanks persona allows you to believe. But then Tom Hanks can go to those darker, less attractive places, and we will go with him. If it were somebody who shut you out from the beginning, I think it would be very, very hard to identify and to care. It's also interesting because when he wins the Pulitzer, the character of McAlary in the play, he gets a kind of, you know, elaborate moment where he makes what sounds like the Pulitzer equivalent of Tom Hanks's Oscar acceptance speech.
Right.
And you think, well, this is someone, Tom Hanks, who knows how to make a speech in this context. It's just usually an Oscar, not a Pulitzer.
How does the audience negotiate that? Because you'd suddenly find yourself watching Tom Hanks.
It really is a credit to George C. Wolfe, no relation to me, the director, who has really given it
checks in the checks in the post, bro.
Hey, George, I told you I'd do this, and I am. It's a real ensemble piece. For instance, I mean, you know, one of the deadening things about New York theater is this terrible tradition, which is ages old, of entrance applause. And sometimes it can be very funny if there's a play that was won last year, a revival of Gore Vidal's The Best Man, that happened to have seven stars in it. There were kind of seven big name stars, including Angela Lansbury and Eric McCormack. And pretty much half the first act was perpetually drowned out by applause as people walked on stage. This isn't happening there. Tom Hanks just comes in and gets immediately into the action. A lot of it takes place in a bar where these journalists would hang out. It has a kind of boozy backroom feel, and he's one of the guys. And I think that's very good as well. This isn't celebrity grandstanding.
I wanted to ask you lastly, because we've gone on about, Tom, we wanted to squeeze in Matilda. Last time we spoke on one of the news shows, one of the other live shows, it was just going to Broadway.
Yeah.
How's that gone down?
Well, I saw it last Friday. It has now opened to the press. Ben Brantley, who's the chief critic of the New York Times, gave it, a review that Matilda Wormwood's parents couldn't have wished better. and so now apparently its advance sale has gone to $17 million. It's funny because there's already a Broadway musical on at the moment about pint-sized, precocious little girls, i.e. the revival of Annie. But Matilda looks like it's going to sort of steamroll across everything in its wake and is the odds-on favorite to sweep the Tonys on June 9th.
Does it translate?
It does in some ways. They love Bertie Carvel as the Trunch, Miss Trunchbull. Bertie was brought over from London to Broadway, and he is, as often happens in New York with British actors, all of a sudden the newly anointed toast of the town. Some of the more specific aspects don't particularly land, and I'm sorry to say that the sound system is such that a lot of Tim Minchin's lyrics are just lost, but hey, it's still a great show.
Nice. We need to get a ticket out there, Emma, don't we?
I didn't even see it in London, so that's an excuse.
Matt Wolfe, as ever, thank you very much for joining us on The Review. And that brings us to the end of the show today. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Majori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilbur and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, researched by Amelia Jen. Our studio manager was Claire Urban.
We hand back over to Georgina Godwin with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time, hosted by Sophie Grove and Mr. Bound.
And I'll be back in 1900 hours, Sergeant Major.
You're hijacking the radio station, Mr. Bound.
I know, the weekly, the whole thing's going on. The culture show's on Monday night. We're going to MIPTV in Cannes. We've got the Istanbul Film Festival and it's Record Store Day. We'll be playing some great records that we're pretending are on vinyl, but are actually MP3s.
Cheating.
I know, I'm sorry. But for now, you've been tuned in to The Review from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Emma Nelson.
Thanks for tuning in.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. a Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.